Chapter 76. A marvel, not the marvel which it replaced, but still a marvel, and fine enough. I am a careless reader, I suppose an impressionist reader. An impressionist reader of what is not an impressionist picture. A reader who overlooks the informing details or masses their sum improperly, and gets only a large splashy, general effect, an effect which is not correct, and which is not warranted by the particulars placed before me, particulars which I did not examine, and whose meanings I did not cautiously and carefully estimate. It is an effect which is some 30-5, or 40 times finer than the reality, and is therefore a great deal better, and more valuable than the reality, and so, I ought never to hunt up the reality, but stay miles away from it, and thus preserve undamaged my own private mighty Niagara tumbling out of the vault of heaven, and my own ineffable Taj, built of tinted mists upon jeweled arches of rainbows supported by colonnades of moonlight. It is a mistake for a person with an unregulated imagination to go and look at an illustrious world's wonder. I suppose that many, many years ago I gathered the idea that the Taj's place in the achievements of man was exactly the place of the ice storm in the achievements of nature, that the Taj represented man's supremest possibility in the creation of grace and beauty and exquisiteness and splendor. Just as the ice storm represents nature's supremest possibility in the combination of those same qualities. I do not know how long ago that idea was bred in me, but I know that I cannot remember back to a time when the thought of either of these symbols of gracious and unapproachable perfection did not at once suggest the other. If I thought of the ice storm, the Taj rose before me divinely beautiful. If I thought of the Taj, with its encrustings and inlayings of jewels, the vision of the ice storm rose. And so, to me, all these years, the Taj has had no rival among the temples and palaces of men, none that even remotely approached it. It was man's architectural ice storm. Here in London the other night I was talking with some Scotch and English friends, and I mentioned the ice storm, using it as a figure which failed, for none of them had heard of the ice storm. One gentleman, who was very familiar with American literature, said he had never seen it mentioned in any book. That is strange. And I, myself, was not able to say that I had seen it mentioned in a book. And yet the autumn foliage, with all other American scenery, has received full and competent attention. The oversight is strange, for in America the ice storm is an event, and it is not an event which one is careless about. When it comes, the news flies from room to room in the house, there are bangings on the doors, and shoutings, "The ice storm! The ice storm!" And even the laziest sleepers throw off the covers, and join the rush for the windows. The ice storm occurs in midwinter, and usually its enchantments are wrought in the silence, and the darkness of the night. A fine drizzling rain falls hour after hour upon the naked twigs and branches of the trees, and as it falls it freezes. In time the trunk and every branch and twig are encased in hard pure ice, so that the tree looks like a skeleton tree made all of glass that is crystal clear. All along the underside of every branch and twig is a comb of little icicles, the frozen drip. Sometimes these pendants do not quite amount to icicles, but are round beads, frozen tears. The weather clears toward dawn, and leaves a brisk pure atmosphere, and a sky without a shred of cloud in it, and everything is still, there is not a breath of wind. The dawn breaks and spreads, the news of the storm goes about the house, and the little and the big, in wraps and blankets, flock to the window and press together there, and gaze intently out upon the great white ghost in the grounds, and nobody says a word, nobody stirs. All are waiting. They know what is coming, and they are waiting for the miracle. The minutes drift on and on and on, with not a sound, but the ticking of the clock. At last the sun fires a sudden sheaf of rays into the ghostly tree, and turns it into a white splendor of glittering diamonds. Everybody catches his breath, and feels a swelling in his throat, and a moisture in his eyes, but waits again, for he knows what is coming, there is more yet. The sun climbs higher and still higher, flooding the tree from its loftiest spread of branches to its lowest, turning it to a glory of white fire. Then in a moment, without warning, comes the great miracle, the supreme miracle, the miracle without its fellow in the earth. A gust of wind sets every branch and twig to swaying, and in an instant turns the whole white tree into a spouting and spraying explosion of flashing gems of every conceivable color. And there it stands and sways this way and that, flash, flash, flash. A dancing and glancing world of rubies, emeralds, diamonds, sapphires, the most radiant spectacle, the most blinding spectacle, the divinest, the most exquisite, the most intoxicating vision of fire and color and intolerable and unimaginable splendor that ever any eye has rested upon in this world, or will ever rest upon outside of the gates of heaven. By all my senses, all my faculties, I know that the ice storm is nature's supremest achievement in the domain of the superb and the beautiful. And by my reason, at least, I know that the Taj is man's ice storm. In the ice storm, every one of the myriad ice beads pendant from twig and branches an individual gem, and changes color with every motion caused by the wind. Each tree carries a million, and a forest front exhibits the splendors of the single tree multiplied by a thousand. It occurs to me now that I have never seen the ice storm put upon canvas, and have not heard that any painter has tried to do it. I wonder why that is. Is it that paint cannot counterfeit the intense blaze of a sun-flooded jewel? There should be, and must be, a reason, and a good one, why the most enchanting sight that nature has created has been neglected by the brush. Often, the surest way to convey misinformation is to tell the strict truth. The describers of the Taj have used the word gem in its strictest sense, its scientific sense. In that sense it is a mild word, and promises but little to the eye, nothing bright, nothing brilliant, nothing sparkling, nothing splendid in the way of color. It accurately describes the sober and unobtrusive gem work of the Taj, that is, to the very highly educated one person in a thousand. But it most falsely describes it to the 999. But the 999 are the people who ought to be especially taken care of, and to them, it does not mean quiet colored designs wrought in carnelians, or agates, or such things. They know the word in its wide and ordinary sense only, and so to them, it means diamonds and rubies and opals and their kindred, and the moment their eyes fall upon it in print they see a vision of glorious colors clothed in fire. These describers are writing for the general, and so, in order to make sure of being understood, they ought to use words in their ordinary sense, or else explain. The word fountain means one thing in Syria, where there is but a handful of people. It means quite another thing in North America, where there are 75,000,000. If I were describing some Syrian scenery, and should exclaim, within the narrow space of a quarter of a mile square I saw, in the glory of the flooding moonlight, 200 noble fountains, imagine the spectacle, the North American would have a vision of clustering columns of water soaring aloft, bending over in graceful arches, bursting in beaded spray and raining white fire in the moonlight, and he would be deceived. But the Syrian would not be deceived. He would merely see 200 freshwater springs, 200 drowsing puddles, as level and unpretentious and unexcited as so many doormats, and even with the help of the moonlight he would not lose his grip in the presence of the exhibition. My word fountain would be correct, it would speak the strict truth, and it would convey the strict truth to the handful of Syrians, and the strictest misinformation to the North American millions. With their gems and gems and more gems and gems again and still other gems, the describers of the Taj are within their legal, but not their moral rights. They are dealing in the strictest scientific truth, and in doing it, they succeed to admiration in telling what ain't so. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.